That's Michael Miles playing, and you'll hear him later. This is Rick Cogan talking, and you'll hear me for the next almost 2 hours filling in, or trying to fill in, for Bill and Wendy in the incredibly efficient way this station runs. And how inept I am, I must tell you now that that news with Ryan Burrow was brought to you by lou2go.com. So that's taken care of. My guest, who I met, who was envious, Patty Toomey, you were envious of the costumes of those young ladies who were in.
Absolutely.
Patty's the executive director of the Pulmonary Fibrosis Foundation, and there are, Patty, a million foundations out there dealing with a wide variety of diseases. Before we talk to an expert on this, your colleague, David Letterer, how did you get involved, and why did you get involved, and when did you get involved? It's located, it's based here, yes?
It is. Actually, we're just a couple blocks away, the national headquarters, from where we are right now. And so I got involved almost unexpectedly, I would say. My mother had the disease, and we didn't know that she had it. She wasn't diagnosed early enough. And unfortunately, she passed within 3 months.
Oh my God.
I know.
I'm
it
so
was
sorry.
So
how
quick.
Long ago was that?
That was about 8.5 years ago. And so, you know, like many who have diseases in their family, this is always a tough time of the year.
Oh, it's
but
horrible.
It's so great to be able to be here and try to be of comfort to those.
Did you even at the time, even though her diagnosis was if not faulty, at least missed it, were you aware of the foundation at all? Were you aware of the disease?
No, and no, I wasn't. I actually had a wonderful job and career at the Field Museum. I was in our wonderful Chicago Cultural Arts. And my mother had shortness of breath. It was right around the holidays, and we said, you got to get to the doctor. And then just a few short months later, we saw that it was more than shortness of breath, and then she declined rapidly. So I was fortunate enough to meet the director of the foundation at the time. It's the founding family, the Rose family.
Mm-hmm.
And that was 6.5 years ago that I joined the foundation. And so it's just been a wonderful experience, yet bittersweet. But I know if I can help other people, that makes it all worthwhile.
That's such a wonderful, altruistic kind of thing to do. I mean, to be drawn to something like that out of a personal tragedy. Good for you. On the phone in New York, where are you, Dr. Letterer? Are you in New York now?
I am in New York at my desk at the New York Presbyterian Columbia.
Well, I hope you admire Patty Toomey as much as I do. You must.
I think I'm Patty's biggest fan.
And back at you, Dave.
Dr. Letterer, how did you get involved? How did you get involved with this organization?
I've been practicing pulmonary medicine. I'm a pulmonologist. I've been practicing pulmonary medicine for over a decade. And one of my major roles is to take care of adults with pulmonary fibrosis. And just about three years ago, Patty and I started talking about a way I could get involved in the foundation. And I've worked over the past 3 years directly with the foundation, building out a lot of the educational messages, mostly to patients and caregivers, but also to healthcare providers.
Let me ask you why, as a physician, you decided to focus on pulmonary issues.
Well, I'll give you a couple of brief answers to that.
They don't have to be brief.
Okay, then I could talk for a long time.
Okay, fire away.
Yeah, well, I mean, maybe let me focus on why I think pulmonary fibrosis is so important and under-recognized. A couple of things. One is that there's a very elegant study done about 2.5 years ago that was published in a very high-profile journal, a medical journal, that to everyone's surprise documented an incredibly high prevalence of pulmonary fibrosis among older folks in the U.S. It was actually about 1 out of 200 people carried a diagnosis of pulmonary fibrosis.
Wow.
At some point in the year 2011. Now, a lot of that's not seen by general practitioners and others because often this disease is diagnosed late. Pulmonologists are well aware of this disease, and unfortunately, the disease is diagnosed towards the end of life after being labeled as COPD or heart failure or asthma or some other condition for years and years. So it's really only towards the end of life that it gets picked up.
At what age, when you say older patients, what do you mean by older?
Well, that particular study focused on Medicare beneficiaries.
So over 65, sure.
Yeah, over 65. Mm-hmm. But the truth is that pulmonary fibrosis can affect anyone at any age, including infants. This disease does not discriminate. Now, there are subtle differences across the age spectrum about the medical details, but anyone can get pulmonary fibrosis.
Is it a viral disease? Do genetics play a part in this? How does one contract? The infant thing gives me chills.
We don't have a lot of answers.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons that we're doing so much research, and the foundation is really leading the effort here, and recently has established a national registry for pulmonary fibrosis patients. This registry has recently, Patty, I don't know if I'm stealing some thunder here, but recently enrolled our 500th patient, and this registry only opened this year. We are rapidly filling the registry. It's full of rich medical data. Full of all the imaging, CAT scan data you can imagine, as well as collecting DNA, genetic samples, and other biomarker samples. This is going to revolutionize how we understand the disease and ultimately how we find a cure for pulmonary fibrosis.
Wow. It occurs to me that with the diagnosis being, well, I come in with shortness of breath and some trouble breathing, that this is, with all due respect to the medical practitioners out there, it seems that this is something easily missed in a diagnosis, yes?
Yes, in a word, yes. And it's this is one of the toughest parts of my job, is seeing people come through my door, sit at my desk with me, and tell me their story, and I got to tell you, nine times out of ten, it's the same story. Doc, I was coughing, I was short of breath, and I got all these different treatments and tests, and it took, 2 years, 3 years before they figured out it was pulmonary fibrosis.
And by then,
we are trying.
Let me ask you, I don't blame the doctors. I mean, this is a tough thing, and I think part of the mission of the foundation is to spread the information to practicing physicians as well. When it is diagnosed almost after the fact, these people you're talking to 2-3 years later, is it a lost cause by then, treatment wise?
No, I would never use that term for our patients or for the treatments we have available. In years past, we had very limited options. Some folks with more inflammatory types of diseases could be treated with kind of standard meds like prednisone, which is a steroid, has a lot of side effects. But fortunately, in the U.S. about 2 years ago, and previous to that in Europe and Canada, new drugs have been approved to treat pulmonary fibrosis.
That's great.
Now, the drugs don't remove the scar tissue. I should tell you, pulmonary fibrosis literally is the buildup of scar tissue in the walls of those tiny little air sacs in the lungs makes it hard to breathe, drops oxygen levels down, and it's progressive. It gets worse over time. These new drugs slow that progression. They cut the rate of progression by half. And so I think that's really good news for many patients who are showing up to their doctor's office, even if they're showing up 2 years or 3 years after their symptoms developed.
Well, I must tell you something. What you've done to me is tell me that the next time I go, literally, to my doctor for a checkup, I'm going to ask to be checked for this. And I see nothing wrong with that. I don't see any doctor saying, no, I'm not going to check you for that. Dr. Letterer, you are very articulate. I can see why you and Patty Toomey get along so well. And I hope you have a lovely holiday season, and I hope you continue to fight the good fight, as we say.
Thank you, Rick. I wish you all the same.
My pleasure. My absolute, absolute pleasure. We'll take a little commercial break, and then I'll talk to Patty about someone is involved in the Pulmonary Fibrosis Foundation, who is a very notable person, and I want to talk to her about the idea that notable people and famous people, and probably soon to be even more famous people, are an invaluable tool for you. So we'll talk about that later on. We just talked to Dr. Dave Letter, who explained to me in chilling but also hopeful fashion what pulmonary fibrosis is and how it is often misdiagnosed or not diagnosed at all. The Pulmonary Fibrosis Foundation, and I'm here with Executive Director Patty Toomey, is in the business of spreading the word in great measure, Patty, to physicians too, mm-hmm. to maybe, hey, if someone comes in, I got to believe that half the people over 65 years old, when the doctor says, hey, how are you feeling, might say, well, you know, I sometimes have a little shortness of breath. If that's how you feel, you tell your doctor to look for this, yes?
Yes, please. And sometimes you don't even get to a pulmonologist right away. That might be at an annual physical that you go to, whether it's your general practitioner, you might get to a community pulmonologist. But it's important to have that exchange with your physician.
No question.
Absolutely.
No question. What is also important when you run, because there are many diseases out there, many diseases that need help from the public and from the medical institution, it is ever important to have, I think, a star attached to it. I know it sounds frivolous, but I think that's very important. And it sounds frivolous because Jerry Lewis mm-hmm. has sort of been made a fool of over the years by his association with a disease. In your case, in the pulmonary fibrosis case, a budding professional football star, and I mean but there's not much to talk about favorably of the Bears season this year. Perhaps the only thing is Jordan Howard.
Who's absolutely fabulous, both on and off the field.
Who has been, his dad, who was a dentist, if I recall.
Yes, in fact, they called him Doc, Doc Howard. And, you know, Jordan and his mother, Flora, came to us. When they came to Chicago, it wasn't enough just to come and to play for the Bears. They wanted to get involved with the community. And then when they found out that our national headquarters is just down the way, they reached out and they said, we would love to honor the memory of Doc Howard.
He's honored the memory since he was in high school,
has he not?
He
sure has.
I mean, that's an amazing.
Yes.
This kid, who I've never met but have watched play and admire him greatly, this kid's the real deal. I mean, this is not like, hey, I better open a nightclub or something here. You know what I mean?
Right.
He has worn a T-shirt with his father's picture on it since he was in high school when he played football during games.
I think, you know, it was such a tragic situation where Doc Howard passed of pulmonary fibrosis. He was 52 years old.
Oh, God.
And so Flora then was trying to raise three young children. Poor Jordan was 12. And so when he went to high school, when he was going to practice, his dad would sing with him, and they would talk before practice would happen. And so he had a T-shirt. They had the picture of his father. And as Jordan, you know, went through high school and then on to college, he still has that T-shirt because he plays in memory of his father.
Well, and he puts his money and his efforts where his heart is, too.
Yes.
He's allowed you to, at various things, to auction off
his cleats.
His cleats, mm-hmm. for which got $1,400. Wait about 5 years, and those cleats
right.
like that are going to get to $50,000.
Absolutely.
But he is actively involved, is he not?
He is, yes. Most recently, he was part of Cleat Week with the NFL, and we came in second place, so we still think he's our rookie of the year.
No question.
He gave it a good run. And he came to us and spoke to all of our volunteers. And I think that's important that when, you know, Dave Letter talked about this, you have to have hope. And so we had a couple hundred people from around the country come. And here comes Jordan out and addresses everybody and gives them hope.
Wow, he seems a very self-possessed kid. He's only 22.
He's 22.
22 years
right.
old. And you you don't just admire him and think of him as a kind of colleague. Now you like him, don't you?
I like him, and you know,
and
what?
His mom too.
You were reading my mind. I adore his mother, and she is a businesswoman. She's a mother. She's a committed, compassionate person. I can't say enough about that family.
And they're in this for keeps.
They are. They absolutely are. Yes.
Let me ask you before I let you go, and it's great meeting you, and happy holidays and all that jazz, Patty Toomey.
Thank you.
You can
Rick.
All go to pulmonaryfibrosis.org. It's a lovely website. You can get all sorts of information, and you can figure out the next time Jordan Howard's cleats will be available for you to buy in order to give money here. this will be an ongoing relationship, I have to believe.
It will. And it's not just in Chicago. Of course, we all want the Bears to do well and we want him to do well. But he actually is on a billboard in Times Square in New York. And so when you look and watch the ball drop, there's going to be Jordan Howard.
Oh, fantastic.
Yes.
That's fantastic.
So it's a national and international effort.
Is there? Will one day you be out of a job?
I hope so. Yes, I hope so.
This is a disease that you think might be able to be eradicated.
We certainly are doing everything that we can. Dave spoke about our national patient registry.
Yeah.
We also have a care center network, which are 40 sites around the country that, God forbid, if you have this in your family or in your community, you can go and get information. You can get a support, be part of a support group. You can go to our conference. So it's while we're trying to further research that's going to get us a cure, we want to make sure you feel supported.
God, that is great. What a great thing. Thanks to Dot Coyle, our mutual friend, for informing me about this. I just think it's something that could be stopped. I do think it's something that everybody over 65, I'm looking at Ben Cortez, who is nowhere near that, but it's like, man, everybody over 65 I know has shortness of breath, and it could be something else, and it could be cured. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays, and thank you.
Thank you, Dot Coyle. We'll get a commercial or two, then we'll get some news, and then we'll talk to Mike Lenahan about his new spectacular book called Much Ado. That's the all-instrumental version, A-Sides, by Michael Miles, who will be in here later this morning as I, Rick Kogan, do my best to fill in for Bill and Wendy. For many, many years, Mike Lenahan has been one of my favorite writers. He would write for The Reader. He would occasionally, but not occasionally enough for me, contribute to The Atlantic, fabulous, detailed pieces, sort of the John McPhee of Chicago. He's written two books now. One, the first one, was about the legendary, we did a radio show about this, a legendary 1963 Loyola Ramblers team, the small school that went on to win the National Basketball Championship. And so I would expect, oh, what's he going to do next? The, you know, 59 White Sox or maybe something else? No, because Mike Lenahan is always full of surprises. His latest book, incredibly, Mike, I must tell you, and thanks for coming in, incredibly handsomely produced, too. I mean, I don't know, you don't have anything to do with that, but you must have in somehow said, look, this book is about a summer with a repertory theater company. It's titled Much Ado. I want it to really look cool. Did you have anything to... This is such a handsome book.
It is a very handsome book. Morgan Crable is the designer who's... responsible for it, and I had nothing to do with it. All I did was say, oh, that looks pretty good. I'd go along with that.
Well, they must have sensed what a magnificent book it was. Again, it's called Much Ado. It seeds, you spent the 2014 summer with the American Players Theater in Spring Green, Wisconsin, near where you have a home, so you're sort of familiar with them. What was the seed of doing that? Because you are, to my mind, a la McPhee, a great in-depth reporter. I mean, you're not just going to do, oh, it's a history of this American Players thing. What's the seed of this book, Mike?
Well, curiosity, I guess. That's what it usually is. My wife and I first went up to Spring Green to see this theater in the early 80s. And... we had what I've come to think of as the typical American Players Theater experience. I didn't know much about Shakespeare. What I did know didn't excite me too much. You know, I had read some in college, and now I know that reading Shakespeare is not really the way to get into it. But it was a thing to do.
And it's beautiful. Describe, tell people about Spring Green and the physical environment up there.
It's a lovely place. As you mentioned, we now have a place up there because we fell in love with it. It's part of the what they call the driftless area of Wisconsin, unglaciated, so it's not flattened out like Illinois is. It's rolling hills and dairy farms and the big Wisconsin River Valley. It's quite lovely. And it's also, Spring Green is also the home of Frank Lloyd Wright's Taliesin, which is another
draws people
to go up there. And this place called the House on the Rock, to which I've never been, but a lot of people go there.
It's like me never being to Sears Tower. It's the same kind of thing. Same kind of thing. And so you did you get, when you first saw the theater company perform, did you immediately get a new appreciation for Shakespeare?
Yes, yeah. I certainly did. What I mentioned as the APT experience, a lot of people report it. It doesn't just happen at APT, but it happens to a lot of people the first time they see a Shakespeare play done really well.
Yeah.
Your reaction is, oh, so that's what all the fuss is about.
Well, many people say, and I know Shakespeare is even not from some friends of mine for the Shakespeare Company in Chicago, tell me that it's not even being taught much. I was taught Shakespeare probably in grammar school. And on a page, or as acted out by your idiot 12-year-old friends, just doesn't do it. The only way to get Shakespeare is to see Shakespeare done well.
That's it. And, you know, I think that teachers, their intentions may be good, but they're ruining Shakespeare for a lot of people. Because a lot of people will never go.
That's right. That was boring. They'll say, that was boring when I first did it. That's a shame, too. But
one of the things that APT does, and Chicago Shakes does it, and any community that's lucky enough to have a decent classical theater company, you know, they bust the kids in by the hundreds, and they make a lot, you know, it's like letting kids into ball games. They make fans for life.
So you get the notion that occurs to you. I know it was, this was 2014 was... the longtime artistic director, I think David Frank was
That's
his name.
Him. Right.
This was going to be his last season. Was that part of the appeal to you for saying, because you do have to say to yourself, Mike Lenihan, author of Much Ado, I'm going to have to spend a lot of my time with these people. Was that part of it?
Well, it was convenient for me. It gave me a hook that this was the big kahuna's last summer as the boss. He let me, he's the guy who's mostly responsible for letting me in to the company. So I knew that his rehearsal room would be welcome. He would try to make me welcome. That was part of it. But the main thing was, well, it's a long story.
Go ahead.
30 years ago,
yeah.
I wanted to write this book.
Okay.
When the company was very young and they were very, they were struggling, they were idealistic, I wanted to embed myself in this company and sort of see how they produced the magic, how they produced this reaction in me that...
Because you first encountered it in the early 80s and they had been founded in 1979?
Their first season was 80.
80, okay, so, good.
They started raising money in 79 and they did two shows in 1980. So I went to the founders of the company back then and tried to get them to talk them into my project.
Yeah,
they were, you know, they had their own problems. They weren't too interested in having me around. But about 30 years later now, this is after we've got a place up in Spring Green. We've been going there summers. My wife and I went on one of these tours that they give, and it all came flooding back to me. What a great story this would be. And this time, the company was different people, of course, and the company was in a little different position, and I was in a different position on the tail end of my career rather than
I think of this as the beginning of your book career.
Okay, well.
30 years in the making, ladies and gentlemen. Much Ado, a summer with a repertory theater company. It is one of my favorite books of the year. I can name you maybe four others or two others. It's not a long read, but it is fascinatingly in-depth, and we'll talk more with author Mike Lenihan. And again, I tell you, ladies and gentlemen, 30 years in the making. You can get it anywhere. I would hope at some things called bookstores, but also online. Much Ado, the author, Michael Lenahan. We'll be right back. And if you are looking for, and you have a few days to do it, a perfect Christmas gift, not only is it a handsome book, it's a brilliant book that will put you in the middle of a summer with a repertory theater company as they produce Shakespeare's Much Ado About Nothing. It is called Much Ado, and it is written by my guest, Mike Lenahan. You could have picked another play, I would imagine. They do, it's a repertory company.
Yes, I certainly could have picked another play. These days, they tend to do two Shakespeares, one comedy, and the comedy is always their big ticket
crowd
item.
Pleaser.
Yeah. So that year, I think I had, if I wanted to do Shakespeare, and I did want to do Shakespeare, yeah. I mean, that's what the company
sure.
is at
sure.
about at its core. I think I had Much Ado and Romeo and Juliet.
Okay.
Could have done Romeo and Juliet. But I gotta admit, and you will appreciate this story, knowing the book that I wanted to do and how I wanted to get into all of the logistics and details of running a repertory company, and given that the theme of my book was like, more goes into this than you could ever imagine when you're sitting in the audience watching it. When I saw Much Ado on the schedule, I just said, you know, there's my title. Yeah. There's my book.
Well, what I got from the book, Mike, though I have some recent flirtation with Shakespeare, is the ways in which Shakespeare's lines can be interpreted. A small line can be done and is done by, I can't remember the name of that lovely actress who you, it done, it, 15, maybe 15 different interpretations of that line. What did you think about that? Did you think this is absolutely, utterly fascinating? And could you, not the director of the play, could you tell the differences when that was happening?
Yeah. You know, I watched virtually every rehearsal of this show. And so I saw the actors trying all kinds of stuff. I think the line you're talking about, the actress's name is Colleen Madden.
Right,
who
right,
will be at
right.
Chicago Shakes, I think, sometime later in this winter.
Yeah, she was Beatrix, right?
Right. There's a line in the play where Benedict professes his love to Beatrice and says to her, "Bid me do anything for thee." And her response is, kill Claudio.
Right.
Two of the most consequential words in any Shakespeare play. The whole plot sort of turns
sure.
on these two words. And modern audiences almost always laugh at this. I don't know, you know, who knows what Shakespeare's audiences did, but they understood something that modern audiences sometimes don't understand, and that is that this is a real blood feud. I mean, she really means kill the guy.
She means it.
Yeah, she
yeah.
wants this guy dead. So it's always a struggle for an actor delivering those lines. What are you going to, you know, the audience is probably going to laugh. Do you play along with what you anticipate their reaction is going to be, or do you try to challenge that reaction and try to make them react differently somehow?
Yeah.
So she tried all kinds of things, you know, saying it very fast, taking several deep breaths before she said it. She did all kinds of things. She never could prevent the audience from laughing. But
was she trying to make them not laugh, do you
yes.
think?
Yes. Yes, I think that's where they wanted to go with the play.
Wow.
They wanted a deeper, darker interpretation of the
yeah.
play than is possible. I mean, what I mean to say is it's possible to do it for laughs, and it's great that way, but you can do it this other way,
I
too.
Also must tell you, there are so many great parts of this book, Much Ado. That part was fascinating to me. I mean, it stands out to me in this wonderful way of the struggle to interpret and the struggle to perform in the way that you want to. And it's also collaborative between the director and the actress, yes?
Oh, absolutely. Not only the director and the actress, but all the other actors in the room. Sometimes the costume people have something to pitch in. And one of the things that fascinated me to learn was to see how much of what you see on stage actually comes out of the actors' heads. Hmm. You know, Shakespeare wrote for his company of actors. They were producing the show.
Right.
He didn't mean for it. He didn't think that it was going to be performed 400 years later.
In the middle of Wisconsin. He didn't even know where the middle of Wisconsin was,
right,
for God's sake.
So he doesn't, the texts that we have don't tell you, you know, deliver the line this way,
right,
or do this,
right,
or do that.
Right.
All they give you is the dialogue. So the actors are free or, you know, burdened with a responsibility, depending on how you want to look at it, of trying to decide what this stuff means and how it's to be played. And it's full of surprises, even though that, you know, some of the actors in this show had done Much Ado three or four times,
sure,
in their lives. The director had never done it, but, you know, had seen it a million times, and there are many films available.
Yeah, you bring up a couple of the films.
Yeah.
I mean, you discuss a couple of the films,
yeah,
in the,
well,
book.
You know, that's the nature of theater is I can't really compare what I saw to other theater because it's gone forever.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Once,
yeah,
the show,
yeah,
is closed,
yeah,
it's,
yeah,
done.
Yeah.
So luckily we have films that we can use. But they have so much leeway to interpret the lines. I remember one of the first shows I ever saw at APT was Taming of the Shrew. The founder of the company, Randall Duck Kim, this really astounding classical actor, played Petruchio, and an actress named Alexandra Mitchell played Kate. And, you know, most of your listeners are probably at least vaguely familiar,
sure,
with the story.
One would hope. This is a smart audience.
Yeah.
Don't admit it if you aren't, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, you know, the conventional reading of the play and what you'd probably read from it as a modern reader reading the text is that Petruchio is, you know, he's taming the shrew.
Yeah,
you know,
right,
he's
sure,
putting this woman under his thumb. But the show that I saw in the early 80s, I'm convinced that they played it the exact opposite, and that Kate had Petruchio wrapped around her finger. She knew every button to push, and she was the one who was taming him. Now, this is 1982, 83.
Yeah, right.
I took it as a sort of feminist girl power version of Taming of the Shrew. But the thing is that, you know, because all you have is the words on a Shakespeare text,
yeah,
you know, you can roll your eyes, you can smirk, you can change the meaning of the words by changing the delivery of them, and you can change the meaning of a whole play.
You know, you do a remarkable job of capturing that. I'm going to keep Mike Lenihan till after the news because I have a few more things to talk about his remarkable book, Much Ado, A Summer with a Repertory Theater Company in Spring Green, Wisconsin. That's not in the title. Mike Lenihan, Much Ado, will be back a couple minutes, and then the news, and he will be back here. I have some more questions for him about how, basically, he addresses how agents deal with their charges devoting themselves to Spring Green, Wisconsin, and not Broadway. That's Michael Miles playing for me, Rick Kogan, doing his best to fill in for Bill and Wendy until noon. You'll hear poet Kevin Koval in about 5, 6, 7, 8 minutes, and then you'll hear Michael Miles play live if he's up to it, but you'll hear him talk. I kept Mike Lenihan on for 5 more minutes because his book, Much Ado, A Summer with the Repertory Theater Company, is a book all of you. This is, it's perfect size too. This is like the perfect stocking stuffer book, but it is also a brilliant read about Mike being kind of embedded with the American Players Theater in Spring Green, Wisconsin, as they get ready to produce and stage Much Ado About Nothing. And he spent the summer of 2014 there. You make a point, Mike, and thanks for staying, to the fact that agents of some of the notable performers in this, these are not like people picked from Spring Green High School to be in Shakespeare. These are professional actors, that some of the agents in New York are, if not confounded by the notion of one of their charges being spending the summer in Wisconsin, which is not Broadway, correct?
Correct. From an agent's point of view, Spring Green, Wisconsin, exactly. Population 1,628 or something like that, your client might as well go dig a hole and hide for the summer. It's not only is it a place where you're unlikely to be noticed by other directors who are give you your next job, it's also a place where they want you to come for 6 months at a time.
Exactly. So it's admirable, then, the commitment of these actors.
Right. Well, there's Colleen Madden, the actress we mentioned before, tells the story of how she came to Spring Green, and it was a situation like that. She thought that the Actors Union was going to be on strike that summer,
uh-huh.
So she thought she could take a chance to go to Spring Green and do some classical theater, which she was kind of interested in doing, but her agent wasn't too sure. Now, what happened is she got to Spring Green. She fell in love with the place. She fell in love with an actor. They bought a house. They had kids. And that's a life that not many actors get to live.
No kidding.
So it cuts both ways. And one of the things that happened in the intervening 15 years from the time she arrived there first to now is that the company became much more formidable. And now a certain kind of actors want to come there. And that's one of the secrets of the company's success, I think. The actors who are drawn there are not the ones who want a big Broadway career or who want to get a television series. They're the ones who really want to do classical theater for an appreciative audience.
I think that is so great. You write in the book, and before I let you go, I want you to tell me what they thought. You write in the book, in the acknowledgments, the stage is a very public workplace, but the rehearsal room is intimate, not really a place for outsiders. I will never forget the warmth and generosity with which the cast and staff of Much Ado welcome me in, or their patience as they endured my pestering and ignorance. It was a privilege to be among them and watch them work. I can only hope they see themselves portrayed accurately and fairly here. How have they seen themselves?
I haven't heard any complaints.
That's good, though.
There was a very delicate dance that went on between the time I finished the book and the time the company could read the book. We were trying to get their cooperation in marketing it, you know, because
sure.
We know that their audience is the most likely audience
for this
book, but they didn't really know what was in the book. So we went around for quite a while, but the book has been out since October. Some people in the company saw advanced copies maybe in September. The company is helping me out.
That's great. That's a great endorsement.
So I haven't heard any complaints. I've tried to welcome them, and I've tried to tell people, you know, if I got something wrong, please let me know. But
so far,
we're all right. Okay.
That's what makes you who you are. Mike Lenhan, one of my favorite authors who keeps coming out. I used to love his stuff in The Reader and then in The Atlantic, and he keeps coming out, not as freaky. He's not James Patterson, so the books don't come out every 4 months, but his last book about the Loyola Ramblers team of 1963, an amazing bunch, especially for anybody as I was 12 years old that year in Chicago watching them win the national basketball championship. His latest is Much Ado, A Summer with a Repertory Theater Company. Very easy to find at your local bookstore. Extraordinarily easy to find online, as is everything. Mike, congratulations. I can't wait for the next one.
Thank you, Rick. I hope we're both still vertical by the time the next one comes
well,
out.
Well, if I'm in a wheelchair or lying down in a hospital bed, I'll still do it. I'll still do it. We'll take a little break and come back, and we'll talk to poet Kevin Koval. This is Rick Hogan doing his best to fill in for Bill and Wendy and talking on the phone to my friend, collaborator. I'm your mentor, right, Kevin Koval? You're not my mentor, are you?
Yeah, no, you're mine. That's
right. Kevin was going to come in because he is having a show Thursday, the 29th at 7:30 at Volumes Book Cafe, 1474 North Milwaukee Avenue. And we were going to try to sell tickets to this thing, Kevin, but you sold out, didn't you?
I don't. Is that the case? I'm not really sure. I just got back from New Orleans, so I'm back in the snow, and I don't know. Is that they say?
Oh, your brain. You're back from New Orleans. When did you get back? Today or yesterday?
Late last night. Yeah.
Well, if you'd gotten back a day earlier, it would have been jolted to a hospital, I'm sure. What were you doing in New Orleans?
You know, it was our good friend Lisa Lee got married, and so we were down there. It was an incredible, beautiful, beautiful wedding, and I was really, really happy to be down there.
Most of the time you travel, it is in the service of Young Chicago Authors, which you head, and Louder Than a Bomb, the yearly poetry festival that you created. That is really spread, as I've tried to chart in the Tribune, really spread across the land, hasn't it now, Kevin?
Yeah, that's what I mean. I've been gone most of the fall and winter because Nate Marshall, who's now the national program director for Louder Than a Bomb, we've been traveling to most of the city. I mean, I think now there'll be 17 to 20 cities this year in North America who are doing their own versions of Louder Than a Bomb. And so, you know, just even recently, the last month alone, we've been in Phoenix, Arizona. We've been in Toronto. We've been all over the country, just kind of seeing how this idea is shaping in other cities across the country.
Well, one of the things, and you and I have talked endlessly about this, is one of the reasons I think the Louder Than a Bomb is a youth poetry festival, the largest sort of thing of its kind, and I think one of the reasons it's spreading, as I've often said, is the lives of teenagers, especially in urban environments, have become much more precarious, and a way to communicate is not always through violence or text messages. I think the reason that Louder Than a Bomb has kind of exploded across the land is the increasing need for a place for young people to express themselves. Is that putting it too philosophically, Kevin?
No. I think that's right. I think there is a myth about this generation that all of the ways to relate to one another is via media or via technology. And I think the truth is that, you know, we still are, you know, these very kind of old school types of animals who require the physicality of space. And so I think one of the things that Louder Than a Bomb does is just create that real proximity to other people. And for an hour, for an hour and a half, for 2 hours, you're in communion with one another around stories. And I mean, you know what, I mean, it's the most ancient of all forms in some ways, you know, I mean, that's the work that, you know, that's the work that you do. That's the work, I think, of this city in some ways, is to really like sit in a space, in a bar, in a theater, in a classroom, and just do the work of, you know, radical listening. And that's what Louder Than a Bomb is. That's the work you do. That's the work that I've been ingrained in, you know, from you to Studs to Haki to Miss Brooks, is to really just sit in an environment with other people who are like you, who are not like you, and just be open to what folks have to say.
Yeah, you know, your message and the message of Young Chicago Authors and Louder Than a Bomb is something that gives me hope. A few weeks ago, I wrote a piece about what words can do to quell violence. And I don't think, when we agreed in the piece, you were in the piece and Hakim Adabudi was in the piece and a number of other people were in the piece, that it can't, that I think the message is understanding one another can go a long way to distilling the fear we all feel and the violence we all suffer. Don't you think it's all about understanding? No one poem or one song or one newspaper story is going to make some kid say, well, I'm not going to go shoot so-and-so today. Don't you think? It's understanding.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. And, you know, we're in this time now of like a deep, great unlistening, you know, the country itself. I mean, you see what, you know, this political moment, you know, and it's been coming for some time. And I think the work that we try to do is to offer a counter reality, a counter narrative for how we might be engaged with one another, you know, regardless of where we come from, regardless of who we are. You know, I think the thing that we believe is that all of us have these essential stories to tell. And what happens too often is that we don't really spend the time listening to one another. We make great assumptions about one another without having the facts and the narrative and the historical truth to back it up. And, you know, of course, once you get down to it, you know, people are very different. Right?
No question. Like, sure.
But there is also, you know, these things, our relationship to our grandmother, their relationships to, you know, local food delights, local slang. And so part of what I think we seek to do is, like, get people to chill for a minute, you know, be even 3 minutes at a time, just really hear one another.
One of the amazing things, not only about the gatherings that Young Chicago Authors has and the outreach you do to schools, is to see Louder Than a Bomb, which takes place. What year is this coming up in the spring? What year?
We're about to have our 17th year.
Oh, my God.
And February 11th through March 18th. Of course, it's, you know, it's a five-week festival now. I think it's one of the premier cultural events.
No question.
And, you know, and it's and in a lot of ways, like, it's indicative of the work we do year-round. So even, you know, the event that you'll be a part of where you're going to talk to Karen Lewis, you know, the Liquor and Luck is at Volumes. I mean, it's all part of the same strategy. You know, it's like, you know, we really are trying to slow things down a little bit to try to, like, sit with, build with one another regardless, you know, and just essentially, like, use the tool of storytelling, use the tool of spoken word, of hip-hop poetry, to traverse the boundaries that keep us segregated. You know, we're using the tools that we have access to, the tools of culture, to reimagine a new city, to urban plan a new city.
Well,
you
I
know,
think,
I mean, we, yeah.
Yeah, you're doing it. 2 seconds about, since we have, I'm going to be interviewing Karen Lewis at that event at,
I'm excited.
At Volumes Book Cafe. Yeah, Karen Lewis, a lot of, few people who don't know Karen realize the incredible depth of Karen Lewis. And plus, I get to see her and have a drink with her husband, John, which is always a treat for me. Kevin Koval is coming out with a new collection of poetry, most of which I have read. It's called, The People's History of Chicago?
People's History of Chicago, yeah.
In poetry. When's that come out?
It comes out, we're going to do the launch party at the Harold Washington Library March 4th. And
the birthday of the city of Chicago.
Yeah.
Well, I will write about that and have you on the radio much in advance of that, Kevin. I will see you Thursday at Volumes Book Cafe, 1474. Welcome back to Freezing Chicago. You'll have to tell me a couple of cool stories about New Orleans when I see you. All right, Kevin,
so
take care of your sweet self. All right, Phil. We'll get a commercial break. I'll read you one of these commercials, then the news, and then Michael Miles will be in here to talk. I want to get his take on what we just heard Kevin Koval say, too, because I think he feels the same way. Welcome back. This is Rick Kogan doing his last fill-in before Monday. I'm also on Monday filling in for Bill and Wendy, or doing my best to fill in for Bill and Wendy. So I'm wishing you all Merry Christmas, which is Sunday. I will not be on Sunday night. Lord knows what they will play. but it's nice to be in here with my friend Michael Miles, who is among the most talented musicians ever to grace any Chicago stage. Michael, how are you? Merry Christmas.
I'm good, Rick. Thanks. Nice to be here.
What do you think of what Kevin Koval said?
Well, you know, you told me that I'd like this guy. So I went to his website, kevinkoval.com, and there's this beautiful poem there called Brothers, right on the as it opens, and further down there was this piece that he did where he wrote a song for Chicago that was sung by Josephine Lee and the Chicago Children's Choir that included the line, and I had to write it down, for all who are here and all who will come, and I just thought, well, this is it. This is what we're about. This is why we talk to one another.
Well, he made some really valid points. Which one of the, you know, you perform all over the place. You have performed all over the world, and you have done a couple of the most amazing theatrical events I've ever seen, because both of them dealt with history. You took two specific years, 1941 and was it 1968?
1968, and we did 1957 as well.
Did I miss 1957?
Well, that's, you know, you get on a roll there with a thing. It's got sequel potential, you know.
But it's very hard to do. They were done at the Old Town School, and they combined video and spoken word and a lot of music. You and I are collaborating on something, aren't we?
Yes, we are. Yes, we are. Once a month, we are now at the Hideout, the third Tuesday, and the very first one is January the 17th.
It's really bearing down on us because
it is.
We don't really know what we're going to do we?
Well, that's why I just handed you that list of 35 things that we could possibly do.
And those all came to you this morning?
Yes, that's right.
Yes, that's how we operate, ladies and gentlemen. It's a finely oiled machine. Michael writes down stuff that came to him in the morning.
Yeah.
But it's going to be music and word and interviews, and we don't really know, which is one of the, to my mind, one of the great joys of it.
Well, there's just spontaneity, but I do like the this list, Rick, was, I mean, we could, I do like the idea of inviting participation from the general public, but there are things we could say on the air, like number one we can say on the air, the outrage of the week, I mean, you could have that. Number two we might not be able to say on the air. The others, a songwriter of the month, a poet of the month, Kevin could be a poet of the month.
He'd be a good one.
Now, Rick, when you were on the air on WBEZ, you used to do those essays. So
yes.
I was saying number 11 there on the list, a new essay from you every show.
There's no question I will do that.
And a tune from me.
Well, because the thing is, Michael is so immensely talented in a way that is absolutely palpable to audiences. I cannot say the same thing for myself, but I would hate for Michael to perform
sometimes
a song.
Sometimes you're not charming, but, yes, but usually you are. You know.
But Michael's playing of the banjo. You've been listening to a little of it on A-Sides. So you can go to hideoutchicago.com, or I'm not sure it's on your site, milesmusic.org.
It's on the, go to hideoutchicago.com is the best place to get tickets.
And it's just, it's an experimental kind of thing. I think Kevin would be a wonderful poet to have on, if not every month. He also has, you know, I love the idea of what he does with young Chicago authors. And there are so many, Michael, there are so many teenage poets who may not wind up being working poets. You know, working poets aren't going to make any money anyway, but who are just so powerful and so also of the moment and what is happening in Chicago of the moment, because many of these kids are in places where some of the worst things in Chicago that make, you know, 35 seconds on the evening news and a short tale in the Chicago Tribune or Sun-Times, that's where it's happening. That's where life is really taking place. It's not all at Water Tower Place here. Want to play a song for show people how incredibly talented you are?
Well, I do want to play a song, but I did want to say to Kevin that idea of my question for him was about encouragement and how best, because there's lots of teachers who'd like to. I work with some teachers the time and. And with students, I have a choir that I direct, and I like to. The question of how to encourage people to speak, young students to speak out, to find their voice, and you know when there's a final performance, of course that's exciting, but there's steps along the way, like the building process for that. That's a and I think my word of the month, Rick, has been the notion of encouragement. And, you know, it's like the people who have encouraged me and my opportunity to encourage others, I see that, you know, there's a lot of hate and a lot of anger and a lot of vitriol out there. And encouragement is kind of like it's active love.
Yeah. Know? No, no question.
And it's,
no
and
question.
It's
you're
it's
in
neutral.
A lot of,
you know, to
you
the people
like,
who are out there in the cold, we can encourage them.
Like you and you, like Kevin, you are in classrooms a lot. And you see this kind of, I think, what is a need, an increasing need for self-expression, because kids don't often get that chance to talk about what troubles them or what makes them happy.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
And that it matters. And
yeah.
And for them to feel, you know, to feel that they can take the risk. You can take the risk to share your ideas.
No question.
In my choir, I had these little girls. I'm in a Chicago public school that has nothing. They have no music, none whatsoever. I worked there as a volunteer, and I had these little girls come up to me and say, I wrote a song. May I sing it to you?
Oh.
And I said, absolutely. I'm going to record it right now, and I'm going to write, you know, and we're going to do this as a choir.
Wow.
And because they see this, this is a relationship that's taken a little while, but now it's safe. I can say, yes, sing to me. She says, yes, I have an idea that I'd like to share. I know it's safe here. I know I can talk to you. And that's, you know, that's what Kevin's got here.
That's what,
on a much larger
you
scale.
Guys, you guys will meet.
So, okay, here's a tune. Yeah.
Is it a happy holiday tune?
This is ancient. We're going to go, this is 1562. In Scandinavia, it's called Gaudete. It was originally sung in Latin, and then it will go to Brittany, the west coast of France, where there's a medley of a piece called Suite de Schottische. So no.
Hold
words.
On 1 second. Should we do it now, Ben, or should we do a commercial and commercial? We're gonna do. Stay tuned through this commercial, because then you're gonna hear Michael Miles. Welcome back. It's Rick Kogan doing his last 12 and a half minutes of something for Bill and Wendy. I'll also be on Monday, the day after Christmas, but Merry Christmas. Happy Hanukkah, happy Kwanzaa, happy everything else. Michael Miles, my great friend, my collaborator, starting Tuesday, January 17th at the Hideout. Go to hideoutchicago.com. We don't know quite what we'll do, but you've heard me talk enough if you listen to me. You haven't heard Michael play enough. That will be the draw. So here, ladies and gentlemen, is Michael Miles. Thank you. sound of four hands clapping. That was beautiful. That was written when?
Well, that was a medley. The first the first piece was called Gaudete. It was written in 1562.
Good God, it sounds very, very contemporary and hip, actually.
Well, they were pretty cool back then. You know? they didn't have the complications that we did. They didn't have televisions and iPhones and things like that to clutter their thinking. And so yeah. As a result, there's a lot of really beautiful music that was written that gets left off. That's called Gaudete. The first one is Gaudete. It's actually a Christmas carol.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
It's sung in Latin, and there's a beautiful version of it by Fairport Convention where they sing those. There's words to it. And the second one was called Sweet de Schottisch, which is kind of a fiddle tune from the west coast of France, where there was a Celtic influence, and so it has like four or five parts to it, and it just has this lovely atmosphere to it that seems rather festive, all inclusive holiday hug, you know.
Well, it was stunningly beautiful. One of the things that distinguishes you, I think, as a musician and a human being is there seem to be no musical prejudices or blind spots for you. You will like things from the American Songbook as well as, you know, Pete Seeger to the Beatles. That sort of eclectic taste, how did that come to be, Michael? Because not all, you know, most great musicians, I think of someone like Corky Siegel, who also has that same kind of eclectic, ecumenical kind of sense of music. How is that bred? How does one grow up without those kind of I hate jazz, I hate classical music?
Oh,
prejudices.
Well, I don't know. I think it's all rhythm and melody, and I kind of have an insatiable musical curiosity, you know, and so as a result, one of the things that I've enjoyed and had the great opportunity over the years is collaborations with lots of different people, lots of different musicians across the world who play all different styles, and we can find a way to make a connection. And in fact, to our Hideout shows, I do have, and we'll be there every month, and I've got the first 3 months lined up with special guests. The first month is with Nora Barton. She's this cellist with whom I've worked. And the second month is Lloyd King, who you've met at one.
Oh, yeah.
He's the saxophone player in Funkadaisy. And John C. Holt, phenomenal guitarist, percussionist. We're going to work as a trio.
Wait, no, I have to. That means I have to find three people who, well, like, what, talk or it, write? Writers.
We can look at our list here. I've got a number of things like
Poet of the Month. You got that, Poet of the Month.
Poet of the Month. Send Dick Durbin a thank you note because... .. I like
Beatles Tune of the Month. Also, there's What's Up with Rom.
Wacky Pet Stories.
What's New at the Zoo.
And this one, too, Rick, I thought maybe number 31. Monthly Folk Tales of the Chicago Aldermen. Once upon a time in the fill-it-in ward of Chicago, something happened. You know, I mean, there's a charming story-filled history there.
Yes,
Chicago
the day
politics.
Patty Baller killed a guy. Yeah. Patty Baller, famous alderman of the 43rd Ward, which would compel you to, if you don't know it, learn and play Winstrocky's 43rd Ward.
Oh, I've heard that song. Yeah. And I've heard your story about your dad, Herman.
And
in fact, we have to mention Herman here because the name of our show, Rick, is
called Panorama.
Panorama.
Which is
Tell us the history.
Arts publication. The first arts publication. Now arts coverage in papers is relatively common in what papers are left. But in 1963, when my father came back to the Daily News, he founded a publication called Panorama, which was devoted to, he wrote a brilliant 40-page memo detailing why the arts and entertainment were a part of the fabric of life and should be covered by newspapers as such. And old issues of Panorama are really, truly amazing. So we're trying to, in that spirit, cover the waterfront in the show called Panorama. You excited about this?
I'm very excited. It'll be 90 minutes, 6:30 to 8, and with this great musical guest. And I think
and cocktails are available.
With respect to our pal Ben here, no commercial breaks, and you can say things.
Yes, we can.
Without impunity, without the bleep button, and the things that
impunity.
Yes, and so the things that you can't say on the air, Rick, that everyone who listens to you knows are simmering inside.
Everyone who talks to me off the air knows are simmering.
That's right.
Inside.
So there's that whole repartee and your stories about Chicago, and you are Chicago's historian.
Oh, that's nice.
And you know,
it'll be interesting, Michael. Wherever it goes, go to hideoutchicago.com and get your tickets. They are not expensive. The Hideout's at 1354 West Wabansia. So before I sign off, Merry Christmas to everybody. Ben Cortez, you've been a joy to work with, as usual, the last 2 days. Kevin Richter, the world's greatest producer, except for Elif Garris, who is my regular producer. And Kevin, it's your first married Christmas, so have a ball, man. A couple years from now, you'll be buying presents for your little kids. Michael Miles will sign off for me.